Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com. My conversation today is with Chris Pronger, investor, entrepreneur, whiskey maker, and Hall of Fame hockey player. Everyone knows Chris from this amazing, storied NHL career filled with intensity, passion. He played on multiple teams, but we spent a lot of time on the podcast speaking about non-hockey related stories and mostly on what he's doing now, life lessons, how his hockey career translated to his passion for business, entrepreneurship, and investing, and how he's now turned that into building an awesome whiskey brand called The Journey, which is all about his journey and everyone's journey through life. We talked about the branding of how this whole thing came about, working with his brother, and then what was very, very fascinating is we spent a lot of time on mindset, leadership, and how Chris used that to basically propel his career over 18 years in the NHL and the passion and intensity needed to keep that up was something that I really took away as an anecdote for how we all need to be in business, and also the fact that our life, our business career is not just one event, one moment for him, the NHL. It's really about our whole journey and our whole life's work and what we do together. We get into all of that, and there's so many different parallels you can draw, whether your kids are aspiring to be an athlete, whether you want to start your own business, or you yourself are looking for to transition from one thing to another, this is the conversation for you. Please enjoy my chat with Chris Pronger. I was mentioning to you that in Florida, and maybe where you live as well, youth sports has completely changed from when I was growing up and probably from when you were growing up, because kids' sports now, like, just they're the whole year. So there's no seasons and there's no seasonality. And I'm sure, given your career, people come to you and always ask you these questions about you know, mindset and what kids need to do and how to deal with young little athletes. So I wanted to start there and get your view on the world of kind of kids sports.
I'm a big proponent of free play, meaning no structure, especially the, you know, young kids, pre-puberty, you know, where you're just experimenting. You're out there working on moves and you're playing around. You're having fun. You're enjoying, God forbid, enjoying yourself as a child. Loving playing a sport, and oh, guess what? Playing multiple sports. Shocker. Wouldn't that be amazing that we don't become China and stick to one sport? How do you know when you're 8, 9, 10 years old what sport you're going to love? Some of the most athletic, some of the best athletes to ever play sports are multi-sport athletes. And so from learning the proprioception of your body and each sport uses different muscles and things within the kinesiology within your body. As a young kid, you need to improve and touch all those to a point to understand how your body moves, how your body articulates, how ultimately what you're good at. And by the way, sometimes what you're good at isn't what you're passionate about. You might love playing hockey, but you're better at baseball or you're better at football. And you just say, no, I want to play hockey because that's what I love. And so I think too often we get stuck in this. My kid's going to be a professional athlete. My kid's going to make millions. My kid's going to do this. How about we let kids just be kids and stop making it a job when it doesn't have to be? Because the stress and the pressure only ramps up the higher you go in the food chain. Until you get to pro sports, and then it's, you know, max. It's maxed out. And depending upon how good you get, it gets even, you know, more stressful and there's more pressure. So we put this undue pressure on kids to perform at a high level for no reason.
Was that your experience when you were growing up, or did you have less pressure and you were just really good and you zeroed in on something?
I had no pressure. I'm from the middle of nowhere, Canada, Dryden, Ontario. It's minus 30 below for 6 months. The road is ice. They throw gravel on it so the cars can drive on it. But, I mean, you could technically skate on it if you wanted to at times. I would play floor hockey in my basement with my brother. We would shoot pucks out at our garage in the driveway. We would play street hockey and road hockey out with all our buddies just out in front of our house. There was an outdoor rink 2 blocks away from my house. We'd go up there. And then obviously the local arena was like 5 blocks away. So we could go there too. And that's just something we did growing up. You know, wintertime was hockey. And then in the spring, you played baseball. In the summer, you swam and golfed and did whatever. And then, you know, I played badminton and volleyball. I mean, I played all kinds of stuff just to try it out and see if you enjoy it, see if you have fun doing it. And then as I just discussed, as I got older and, you know, started to be more proficient in one sport and loved solely focusing on hockey, I still didn't play only one sport. I played lacrosse when I played junior in high school. And then I golfed in the summer and I did, you know, you should never be a one sport athlete. Your body is not meant to do that repetitive motion over and over and over. You got to give your joints a break. And I think we see more and more young kids get to college and they're either burnt out or they get injured because of the constant repetitive use of the motions for different sports, whether you're a pitcher in baseball or whether you're, you know, throwing a football or, you know, playing hockey, your hips are not meant to make the motion that skating motion. They need a break to recover and regenerate.
When does your professional mindset develop?
I always wanted to be good and you want to play to the best of your abilities. I don't know if It wasn't until I got to junior, like I said, from the middle of nowhere. You got to remember, this is pre-internet, pre-knowing exactly what's going on. So I don't know how good I am. You don't know how you stack up against the alleged best in the country. You never play against them. You know, it's just, you play in your own little town in your own area and you play amongst all those kids and, you know, you're pretty good up there, but you don't know how you stack up. And then once I went to a couple tournaments down in Toronto in the GTA, where hockey hotbed, you're able to compare yourself against these guys that are talked about as, oh, he's the next this or the next that. And you're able to kind of see how your game compares, how you match up. And, you know, I went and played junior B in Stratford and played against these highly touted, highly rated prospects that were going to be drafted into the Ontario Hockey League. And you're playing against them the whole year. You're like, oh, I mean, you're just as good as they are. And you're in that, you're being talked about in that realm. And then you go to camp, junior training camp, and you're playing against first round draft picks and highly touted prospects in the NHL. And you're like, these guys aren't that good. You know, they're good, but you're comparing yourself to them. You're like, well, I can play against these guys. You know, you don't have any bias yet because you haven't seen them play. You don't really know how good they are compared to other people that you played against. So it's, you don't really have a comp set yet. So for me, I was going into everything blind and everything just trying to figure out where I fit and how I could develop. And it wasn't until then that I thought, oh, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can be a pro. And ultimately made that decision. Instead of going to play NCAA hockey, I decided to go play junior hockey.
What is the biggest misconception about leadership in professional sports?
You know, I think the biggest thing is, oh, he's got the C on. He's the leader. One guy does not lead a locker room. It takes a village. If you're the captain and all I hear is your voice over, it's like a coach. You hear that same voice over and over again. At some point, you're going to tune them out. And so that's why there's a leadership group. And that's why not only is it the leadership group, but it's everybody is a leader to a certain extent. Yes, there are followers. Yes, there's guys that you can drag along with you, but they still got to lead themselves. They still got to be accountable to themselves in the way that they play. And it's about buying in and getting them to buy into A, what the coach is selling, or B, what you're pushing as the leader and what the leadership group is saying. This is how we play. This is how this room is going to operate. You need to fall within these parameters for us to be successful. And you're pushing people. You're holding guys accountable. You're holding yourself accountable first. You know, I was big on, okay, if I'm going to ask you to do something, I better be doing it too. And I'm going to go above and beyond what I'm asking you to do so that you can't sit there and say, well, you're not even doing it. Why would I do it? So you get that core group and, you know, one guy might be loud. Another guy might be a blood and guts guy. Another guy's quiet, but experienced. And he, you know, when he talks, everybody listens because you don't really hear him talk much. You know, there's always a good balance and there's always a good cross section of personalities that can really help guide and steer the ship, you know, so that it's not always just that same guy over and over grinding on people. And, you know, some people are better at saddling up next to a guy and putting an arm around him and figuring out what's going on. You know, is there something outside the rink that's a distraction? Is there something going on? Is, you know, so you're able to kind of really dig in and one guy cannot, you can have a pulse on the team, but you're not going to know everything. You can't be there. If four guys are struggling, you can't be there with all four guys. And that's where the leadership group comes in. And ultimately the captain gets a lot of the blame and he gets a lot of the praise, but it takes the collective group to really excel and take it to that next level.
Your career was really long and incredibly successful in the Professional Hockey League. Where did the drive for an intentionality to have a long career come from?
I don't know if I set out to play 19 years and and all the rest of that. I think I just loved playing the game. I loved playing in the NHL. I loved challenging myself. I loved competing. You know, I loved developing and getting better. And you know, each summer you set goals to improve your physical fitness and your mental approach to the game and all these things. And then you get into the training camp and you're working on your craft and your team game. And then I always looked at the off season and the season as you have to continue to get better or you're going backwards because everybody else is getting better too. Whether they're gaining experience, whether they're improving their hockey sense or their physical abilities. And so, you know, I always knew it was going to be time to hang it up when I stopped getting better. And so I just constantly pushed myself to get better. And then the next year goes on top of the next year, on top of the next year. And along the way, I had a few pretty significant injuries that, you know, were potential career wreckers or enders. And, you know, you battle through those too, but you continually work on your game and try to improve. And, you know, that's part of being a leader too, is continually improving as a player, as a person, as a leader.
Do you think that having the beginning part of your career being in professional hockey was at all like a disadvantage for what you're doing now? Or do you look back on it and say like, it was tough to transition to what I'm doing now because of my hockey career?
I would say it was a blessing and a curse. And I say it was a blessing because when you play a professional sport, you learn how to be a good teammate. You learn how to work together. You learn the value of hard work and discipline and structure and all the things that are not unique to great organizations and great businesses. It's a curse because people only want to call you, oh, there's Chris the hockey player. There's, you know, there's so-and-so. Oh, he's a basketball player. Oh, he's a football player. And it's such a small part of your life and a small part of who you are that if you don't push away that stigma of, oh, he's an athlete and, oh, he, you know, oh, he's just a dumb athlete. Oh, he's just this, he's that. And they don't get to know you. You know, you may play with reckless abandon and play like a crazed animal out there and that might be how you play, but then, you know, they don't know you off the ice. They don't know who you are, really. They just know the persona, or as I like to call it, the alter ego of how you played the game.
Is there a similarity to that and your business career? Do you have a persona now, or is it completely different?
It's completely different. You know, I think, because of my size, when I'm in a room, people are intimidated to a certain extent. You know, you can tell I played a sport of some sort. I'm tall. I'm in good shape. You know, so people automatically think, oh, you must have played a sport. I typically get, did you play basketball? I'm like, no, I can't jump. But, you know, I think for me, it's more about being disarming and trying to alleviate me hovering over top of people and you know, having the resume I have. And, you know, they want to talk about that, but they don't want to talk about exactly why I'm there and what we're talking about, you know, whether it's business or investment or what have you. And so it's a nice opening line, but after that, let's cut to the chase. Let's talk business and let's do what we're doing here. So, you know, it you know, again, it goes back to it's a blessing and a curse at the same time. And how you participate in the conversation and try to steer it away from your career and steer it back to why you're there. Okay, great. We're talking about that, but let's focus on this. I didn't come here to talk about myself. I didn't come here to talk about my career, or my former profession. Let's talk about this right now.
How did your passion for investing start?
Well, I was a millionaire at 18 years old and I needed to figure out exactly what I was going to be doing. I don't know any 18-year-olds, well, I shouldn't say any, but very, very few that have any clue or semblance of what to do when they're successful and, you know, get that type of money at that age. And so I had great people around me, and my dad was an accountant, my mom was a teacher. I lived my first year in Hartford with a family that are dear friends, and he helped guide me as well. and kind of put my money over here. And you know, I bought a Ford Explorer. I needed a car when in Hartford, so I bought a Ford Explorer. You know, I wasn't, I'm tall, so I wasn't going to be buying a Ferrari or a Porsche or any of that, those things. Plus, I was in Hartford, so I needed something to get through the what snow we did get. So I needed to be smart in that regard. So, you know, it just, you're going to make mistakes along the way. I was fortunate enough to have a really good semblance of an understanding of money and an understanding of what it can do. I'm not going to say I was proficient in any sense. I made my fair share of mistakes. You know, there's lots of things that I would change, but there's also a lot that I wouldn't change. And that also becomes the dynamic and the, you play that what if game. Well, if I didn't do this, and you can go back 1,000 steps and start playing that, and things happen for a reason, and they're all learning experiences. I was fortunate enough my first 2 years in Hartford, I played with Brad McCrimmon. I was 18 and 19 years old, and he was 36. So he, you know, my dad was 40, whatever, you know, early 40s. So, you know, he could have been my dad, you know, so it was a valuable learning experience, but something that I look back on, and he walked me through how my career was going to play out. You know, we talked about being a professional, dealing with the media, the mistakes that, you know, you're going to make, and you got to watch out for this, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen. And I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever, beast. Yeah. And sure enough, the funny part is I played my 1,000th game in Detroit, and he was an assistant coach on the team. So, you know, he comes over, and, you know, I'm talking to him before the game. He congratulates me, and he hands me a letter. He was like, you know, open this after the game, you know, on the bus, whatever. And I read it, and he's just like, you know, all the memories of that, those first couple of years. And he was my roommate, my D partner. We, you know, we're at dinner, lunch together on the road every day, every game, you know, every road trip. You know, I don't know too many 36-year-olds that want to hang out with an 18-year-old. So it was, you know, it was eye-opening at times. And I got to hear a lot of great war stories and, you know, things of that nature. And I was a big history buff and things of that nature. So got to hear about all the old-time guys and kind of all the stories. But everything that he told me came true. Do you think I listened to 100% of it? Absolutely not. There were a few really good nuggets that, you know, whether I implemented into my game or I used, but like anything in life, if you got to experience it yourself, you can know it's kind of hovering over here in the background because he's in your subconscious and he's the little birdie on your shoulder, but you have to experience it all on your own. And you know, sometimes we're not smart enough to recognize the advice that we're being given. And you know, I always look back on a lot of the things in my life and the things that he was adamant about and he preached about, and he was on point with virtually 95% of it.
Was there one thing in particular that he preached that you didn't listen to?
I wouldn't say that I didn't listen to. You know, I don't think at the time you're being that snot-nosed little kid or that young punk that maybe you're then looking at, because that I played my 1,000th game. I think I was 32 or 33, you know, so I was getting close to the age he was at. And he's like, oh, so how are the young guys on the team and how's dealing with all this? He's like, you know, I had to deal with that same crap with you too. So just, you know, going through that with him, and I'm like, no, I wasn't like that. He's looking at me like, yeah, okay, whatever. Keep telling yourself that. So it was, you know, intriguing to kind of hear his, now that I'm the similar age, to hear his backstory and how he perceived me at that age, and maybe how I perceived myself as like always being that guy that was listening and following directions and doing what I was told, and maybe wasn't really paying attention to all the pushback and things that I was like, yeah, whatever, run along. You know, and then, you know, I had already had it in my game, but he was always very adamant. He's like, you need to be unpredictable. And I'm like, well, yeah. He's like, no, you got to be unpredictable. You need your opponent. You need the other team to not know what you're going to do next, whether you're going to take the puck, spear them in the nuts, slash them in the back of the leg, chop their arm, break their, whatever. Just keep them on edge. It's going to give you that extra second to get the puck, move it over here and get on the attack and things of that nature. And I kept that with me. I already had a good part of that in my game, but he was the reinforcing factor of, if you do this, it's going to pay dividends year after year after year. And so I always made sure to, if I got away from anything, I always made sure that I took a pound of flesh every couple games just to let everybody know that I was still there and still willing to do it.
Love it. How were you thinking about life after hockey while you were playing hockey? Because having gotten to know you a little bit, I can't imagine that you didn't think about that, because it seems like your plans post-hockey are bigger than your hockey plans.
Yeah, I think the first, you know, the first few years, you're just trying to figure it out. You're trying to learn how to be a pro. You're learning how to play the game the most effective way possible, how to help your team win, what you need to do to continue your growth and your development. And that, you know, that was a good 4 or 5 year process for me. And then once I got to that spot, probably after year 4, I was starting on a glide path of figuring out, okay, how I needed to train in the off season, what I needed to do in season to maximize my game and efficiency, eating, you know, right when I was coming into the league, the, you know, physical fitness became, you know, guys used to show up and use training camp as a way to get into shape. And just prior to me turning pro, that whole fitness thing started and guys were starting to show up in better shape and weren't getting out of shape in the summers and taking their games to that next level. So I showed up at that right time where I was learning from the veterans and learning, you know, what it took to be a pro day in, day out, how to handle the media, how to handle the notoriety, you know, money, how does that work? What do other guys do? You know, right a couple of years before I turned pro, that's when in the NHL, that's when salaries kind of took off and guys started to make more than $1 million and things like that. So I was coming in the league at the right time for a number of different reasons. And so I tried to use that as a springboard to get my career where it needed to be. I, you know, I had my fair share of struggles. I had a DUI after my first year. I had, you know, I had an issue in Buffalo during my first year. There's all kinds of things that, you know, thank God there was no internet. You know, there was TV still, so no internet, no social media, no nothing. So I kind of cruised by with some of that stuff, but you know, you learn a lot about yourself. And the nice thing is, you learn a lot about who's in your corner. You learn about who your real friends are, who's there to support you, who's there when you're tied, just don't tie too many. You know, so it actually was a blessing. A lot of those things happened to me early on in my career, because then I could weed out a lot of the people that were just hangers on and were just there to kind of grab on for the ride and weren't really invested in my success. And so all that's going on. And then I started to make more money. I had a contract that was incentive laden that as I started to play better, I started to make a lot more money. And, you know, I just started becoming more interested in, you know, reading about investing, reading about real estate, reading about all these different things that were being presented to me. And I was always of the mindset that I wanted to understand, I wanted to know what I was investing in, so that when I'm sitting there and my financial people are talking to me about what they're doing, I'm not just sitting there dumbfounded and going, okay, sounds good, great. I want to know why they're doing it. Why are we doing it? Why are we investing in this over this? Why does that make sense versus this? And challenge them a little bit to give me better answers. And so you're able to kind of keep a firm grasp on you know, what you're doing. And I see all these athletes that give up power of attorney and things of that nature. And those are the guys typically that get taken for everything. And, you know, I think athletes need to understand and need to know that most people do not have their best interests at heart. And they're there for the glory days and along for the ride and to get their cut. And then they're on to the next one. And so you have to be trusting, but you got to, let's call it trust, but verify. And you have to make sure that people are with you for the right reasons.
What were the investments you were most drawn to while you were playing?
You know, I think early on, it, you know, you're investing in the stock market. You know, I'm 18, 19, 20 years old. It's all going in the stock market. I built a cottage back home to go back to in the summer times. You know, was that smart? Probably not. But, you know, whatever. You know, those are things like you get something in your head and you're like, no, I want to own my, I want to have my own place. I want to have, you know, it's just for whatever reason, we want to do what we want to do. And nobody's going to tell us otherwise. Was it an efficient use of my capital? Probably not. Could I have done a lot better things with it? Probably, but it served a purpose and in the long run, maybe kept me out of greater trouble. But you know,
being off in the woods?
Well, probably more than that. My nickname, you got to remember, was Chaos back then. So, you know, I was trying to find myself, trying to figure out who I was. You know, you move away at home from 15 and you're playing hockey and playing a sport and you're trying to figure out who you are. You're being told you're Chris the hockey player. You're a dumb hockey player. You're this, you're that. You know, you get hit with the stigma of being an athlete and you're trying to figure out what you are outside of your sport and who you are and what you're all about and what your values look like and things of that nature. So it's, you're doing a lot of soul searching and trying to find out what your real identity is, who you really are. It's not easy being in the spotlight, so to speak, and trying to figure out who you are and what you're all about. And so the first few years was really more about, I was playing and doing that, but in, you know, in the summers you're training, but you're also trying to figure out who you are, what you want to be all about. And you know, you made my fair share of mistakes, as I said, and you kind of learn from those and continue down your path. And it's never a straight line, you know, success. Everybody wants to look over here at all these great accolades, but they forget all of the peaks and valleys along the ways, the highs, the lows. And, you know, it is not for the faint of heart. You have to have a lot of discipline. You have to have a lot of moxie fighting through injuries, doubt, fear, all kinds of different things that can become negatives as you're trying to build your career and build out who you are and what you're all about and who you want people to know you as.
How have you figured out how to leverage your journey to figure out who you are today?
I don't know if I figured that out yet. You know, I think the biggest thing that I can do is when you meet, you know, people know who you were as a player, which is the persona on the ice, as we talked about, that's your alter ego, and then who you are off the ice. And a lot of places, they don't know who you are because they don't know you. They only know that person that played a sport. And they've only really seen you talk with the media, which can be terse at best, depending upon where it is and what they're asking you.
Well, that's probably good advice.
Yeah. And then it's really, you know, you're in your home, you're in your the city where you play, and those are the people that get to meet you and know you. And so it's really more about how you invest in the community where you live, how you give back, how you act, meaning, you know, are you walking around like you think your shit don't stink? Are you, you know, walking around oblivious to the world and oblivious to everybody else around you? Or are you an active participant and engaged in the community? And, you know, whether that's through charitable endeavors or foundation, you know, people go a different direction, foundations and things like that. How are they giving back to the community that has given to you? And so early on, when I got here to St. Louis, I found a couple charities that I was passionate about that spoke to me. You know, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital is one that I've been invested in and doing a lot of work with since like the 97, I think, something like that. So, you know, you find things that speak to who you are, what you're all about, who you want to help and give back, and then, you know, how you are in the community and how open you are about helping people. You've got a platform and a gift, and how you use it matters. And then that speaks to people around you and informs people as to who you are and what your values are. And, you know, then they see your family and they see how active you are with your kids and, you know, going to different functions and things of that nature and how accessible you are. You know, are you willing to have a conversation with people? Yes, some people are morons and they ask stupid questions. And you know what happens when you ask a stupid question? You get a stupid answer. But for the most part, when people engage you in a nice manner and aren't rude, you have a conversation. You know, your dad, your kid's playing whatever sport and you're there to watch, or they're singing in the Christmas pageant and you're there to watch, and you're all there as parents and you're all there watching your kids, and you know, you need to, we'll call it, integrate into the community, you know, and not have you set up on a pedestal over here. You're just Joe Blow citizen. And, you know, I think sometimes that's where, whether it's athletes, celebrities, whatever you want to call them, they get a little sideways when they start. You know, I learned a valuable lesson my first year in Hartford. I played in the Greater Hartford Open, which is now the Travelers, and I played in the Pro-Am, and Jim Rice was there hitting golf balls and goes out to play. And these kids come up to him and ask him for his autograph. And he said, no, I'm here working on my game. And that stuck with me throughout my whole career and now post-career. You're retired. You're out of sight, out of mind. If I go down to Enterprise Center and go watch a Blues game, 75% of the kids and young adults in there were not alive when I was playing for the Blues. They might know my name, they might see my jersey retired, but they don't know who I am. And so when people ask you for an autograph, I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever, no problem. Like, you know, because that watching that guy do that just stuck with me. And these kids looked at him like, what? You're not a golfer. You're a baseball player. And so, you know, how you act, you might act like a lunatic on the ice, but how you act off the ice, I think people are always shocked with how nice hockey players are off the ice and how engaging they are and how willing they are to have a conversation. Or they see two guys fighting on the ice and then they go to the local bar and they see them having a beer talking about the fight or talking about, you know, their families or whatever. So it's always interesting when people are like, you guys really talk like that? And I'm like, yeah, sometimes.
It's funny. I'm laughing because I'm reminded of a story. I took my son to a hockey game. We were sitting on the glass right by the penalty box. It was the Panthers. And one of the players had just gotten in a fight. It was a Panthers player, came back to the penalty box and he was bleeding. And my son kind of leaned into the penalty box to look and see the blood. And then the hockey player turned at him and started making funny faces and stuff. And my kid just freaked out. It was amazing. And all the hockey players that I know, that's exactly how you described it. I want to talk a little bit now about why you had the idea and how you got the idea to get into the liquor business.
Well, a couple reasons. You know, we talk about, the world doesn't need another whiskey, but it definitely needs another story. And the journey is really, you know, our tagline on the bottle is celebrate your victories, be proud of your scars, and enjoy the journey. We're all on our own unique journey. We all have a story to tell, whether you're an athlete, a plumber, a real estate guy, whatever. We all have our own unique story. We have our own path, how we get there, you know, and really the genesis of it, as my brother and I like to say, that we've done a lot of R&D over the years, 35 plus years, don't do the math, but you have a, let's say you close a big real estate deal and you're all excited, this is great, pour a glass of whiskey, you want to tell somebody about it. You know, you want to tell the story and regale about what happened, all the different things, that how it played out over a glass of whiskey. You have a terrible day. You lose a deal. Oh my God, it completely sucked. What do you want to do? You want to pour a glass of whiskey. You want to tell somebody about it, friends, family, whomever, and just walk through. And so throughout our careers, my brother played for 16 teams in 11 years. And we had started talking, you know, 4 or 5 years ago about trying to figure out something we could do together and kick tires in a couple different businesses, and nothing really made sense. And then this idea was presented to him, and, you know, he brought it to me, and I'm like, oh, okay, how does it, you know, how can we make this work from a contractual basis and, you know, investment, et cetera. You know, what do they need us to do? How does that layout work? How does that structure work? And then it was, okay, if I'm doing this, and so most people know this about me, if I'm doing something, I'm all in. You better be all in too, because I'm going to know everything about that business. I'm going to invest myself in learning about that business. I'm going to talk to everybody I know in that business. I'm going to link in with everybody in that business so that I can learn and understand and build a network. And I think maybe after the first month, as we're talking about this and going through what we want the liquid to taste like, what the branding is going to look like, what name do we want? And, you know, our partner at Niagara Falls Craft Distillery was like, oh my God, this guy's relentless. Like, slow down. And I'm like, well, are we doing this or not? If we're doing this, we're doing this, and let's get moving. And so, you know, we built the liquid from scratch. You know, we had a baseline and we're like, all right, this is what we like, but we want the flavor profile to have this, this, and this. And, you know, my brother lives in California. I'm in St. Louis. So we would FaceTime, we'd get our sample. We would, you know, sample it. We'd be like, all right, take notes, talk about it, describe it. What do you taste? What do I taste? What do we not like? What do we like? And we send the notes back, like, all right, get on a call. Here's what we want fixed in the next batch. A month later, we'd get another sample. So we do that another time. Then we get to the third iteration and we get on FaceTime, take a sip, look at each other and go, this is exactly it right here. That bottle has exactly what we tried on that third sample. And so, you know, when we started this 2.5 years ago, startup, who needs another startup? But, you know, I think as we've gone through this, build it out, go through the contractual process, go through the distributor process, go through building out the liquid and the regulatory and all the things that I probably didn't think out in that first, yes, I agree to do this phase. Now it's been a very good learning experience, and to have a really good understanding of the business, the space. No, it is not easy, but as I always like to tell people, if it was easy, everybody would do it. And once something's not easy, you can go one of two directions. You can say, oh my God, it's too hard. Or you can say, okay, here we go. And step into it a little bit more and put the effort in. So I'm of the latter. And so live 8 months now in the marketplace. We're in Missouri, Southern Illinois. We're in New York. We're in Ontario. We're in Alberta. and we're just getting ready to roll out in Texas. So those are our five core markets that we want to focus on. Those are five markets that Canadian whiskey is very big in. And obviously, you know, Texas is massive. New York is massive. Ontario is the number one seller of booze in the world. And Alberta is another big market. So, and Missouri is where I live. So I can have boots on the ground and I'm here most of the time. So I can be in places and talk to people and, you know, get feedback and testimonials.
100%. What's the most important factor that you've learned in having a successful Canadian whiskey business, or really adult beverage? I think they're probably all the same key factors.
For the most part, they are almost all the same. At the end of the day, it's liquid to lips. It's getting people to try your product, getting it in their hands, letting them make a decision on whether they like the product or not. Is it good enough? Does it speak to them that it's going to replace whatever they currently drink? You know, and it's just, that takes time. That it's just an arduous process that takes time. And it's, you know, it's one consumer at a time, one store at a time, one restaurant at a time, one bar at a time, it just takes time. And as you grow, you're able to market a little bit more. You have more dollars to throw behind marketing and, you know, investing back into the company and things of that nature. So we have a good system, we feel, to invest back into the company. And, you know, everybody is on the same page. Everybody is of the same mindset, which is great, you know, and which was a big part of that initial conversation and formulation of our business structure and how we were going to run things. And I think we're set up for success. It's just like anything else. It just takes time. And once you kind of get your foothold in somewhere, you then got to branch out and just continue on in that process. One house at a time, one county at a time, one state, you know, just one city, one county, one. It's just ever evolving. And so we're excited, but it's work. And what isn't? At the end of the day, it's all work.
Brian Rosen from InvestBev told me that Tito's didn't fully take off until they kind of changed around their branding. And I think they wrote like handcrafted in USA or something like that. And then it really started to take off.
Handmade and gluten-free.
So how intentional were you about the branding and what was your branding story?
Yeah, it's really more just about the story and how invested we are in everyone's journey. My journey is unique to me. Yours is unique to you. And really just telling those stories and being a part of it is really what the journey is all about. And the more we can get in front of people, and, you know, my brother and I are starting a podcast. You're on the list. Don't you worry. 'Cause we want to know about your journey. And as it's not only about athletes, like, I think that's where people get a little sidetracked. It's not about an athlete's journey. It's about everybody's journey. Everybody has their own unique story in how they got there. You know, I was up in Toronto this past weekend doing a few junkets for the journey. And in the process, I ran into our old team president in Philadelphia, Peter Lucco, who's had an incredible journey. And we're going to have him on the podcast. And we're going to talk to him about how he got his start, because it is so interesting to hear. People probably don't even know who Peter Lucco is, but he's integral to so many different stories that they don't even know about. The Eric Lindros saga, the how I got traded to Philadelphia. Like, there's all these things, and they, you know, they think it's maybe over here, this shiny balloon over here, but he's actually a piece over here that is out of the picture or just over here outside the camera and, you know, has a unique take on it and a unique understanding of the backstory behind a lot of these things. And that's the journey we want to talk about. And how did that shape his business career? And so, you know, we're excited about things like that, that allow people the opportunity to talk about their journeys and how we can be a part of it.
One of the downsides, I think, of social media and just people having greater audiences today is that people mostly just talk about all the success they've had and they skip over the failures, which probably are actually more interesting for someone else to hear about. Why were you so specific about including scars as part of the branding on the bottle?
Well, my brother played for 16 teams in 11 years. So he is the journeyman, the original journeyman. I played on five. You know, you look at all the accolades I got, I played on five teams. So you could argue that I'm a journeyman, you know, and you know, I've made my way around the league and Hartford, St. Louis, Edmonton, Anaheim, Philadelphia. And each place had its own separate journey. And so the story just does not talk about all of this bright, shiny stuff up here that's awesome and everybody wants. I got thrown in jail. I had a DUI. I had, you know, all that stuff, all those scars. I had two career-threatening injuries. One was ended my career. You know, all those things, all those negatives help make you who you are. It's not only the positives. It's not only the wins and the victories and the championships and the accolades that make you who you are. It's all those scars and all those failures, all those defeats, all those mistakes that help mold and guide you more, actually more so than the wins. I hate losing more than I like winning. I hate losing, but it's an integral part of self-reflection and improvement. Is you're gonna lose, you're gonna fail, and what you do from failing, what's the saying? Knock down seven times, get up eight. I mean, is it day one or one day? You know, all those sayings that we hear all the time, kind of speak to everybody's journey and how it evolves.
What have you found to be the best way to bounce back from a failure? Sounds like a cliche question, but it's actually pretty hard to do.
It is a lot of discipline. It is a lot of, you know, there's going to be doubt. There's going to be fear. There's going to be that voice. Oh my God, do you really want to do it? Do you really want to do this? Is it really worth the work or the risk or the heartache? And then it's, you know, the David Goggins, the inner bitch over here. Like, really? Do you want to, is that how you want this to end? Is that the example you want to set? And it's a matter of what is it going to take? Is it going to take hard work? Okay, fine. Are there situations and circumstances where this is not working? We need to pivot? Yes. Is there situations where this does not work? We need to shut it down? Yes. All of those things happen. Those are failures along the way to success. And those are life lessons and learning lessons that are then going to take you to the promised land, whatever that looks like for you. Because the promised land or success is different for everybody. You know, happiness is what you want. What makes you happy? And then how can you fulfill that?
How did you think about picking the partners that you have in Journey? How did you know they were going to be good partners?
I think you look at, you ask questions in the early days, how is this going to be structured? How do you, you know, for instance, you know, okay, you play the what if game. What if we got offered $10 million? Would you take that? No. Why? Because it's not going to move the needle. I got to pay tax on that. I got to do all these things. Is it a lot of money? Yes. But is it going to move the needle to what you think this can get to? What is the grand vision? Where do you think this can get to? Why do you think it can get there? How can you execute to get there? Well, then why would you take that? I wouldn't. Okay. What about 100? Well, yeah, I'd have a conversation about that. What does that look like? How does that, you know, and you just start going through these examples as to, okay, you take that. Why would you take that? How would you structure it? And now you've got a baseline for any potential conversations. You know, somebody comes in and said, I'll give you $10 million. No, I'm not doing it. Why? Because it's not in our plan and I don't want to do it. And now you move on. Okay, well, You know somebody's interested in you. Okay, great. We're clearly doing something right. Somebody's interested. Okay, let's keep executing. Let's keep going down. Let's look at our data. What do we need to fix? What did they say why we were worth that? Okay, let's you know, it is just keep going down that path, keep digging deeper into why were they interested in it? How were they going to use it? What were they going to do? And then keep moving forward and adapting, and hopefully you get to your number.
A lot of times when you're negotiating a contract, everyone always says, you know, yeah, this is in here, but it's never going to happen. This is never going to come up. I actually think the best question is, or the best scenario is exactly what you're doing, like gaming what would happen. And not just saying what's never going to come up, ask them what would happen in that situation.
I listened to Brian talk about the private equity part. Yeah, great. All right, private equity is going to come in and invest. Well, now you got to take it up to here. Yeah, but I don't want to do that. But now you got to, because that's their playbook. And so you have to be very detailed and understand what all that looks like. Do you want a partner? Now you got somebody else looking over your shoulder. Well, why are you doing that? Well, this is why. Well, no, but you should do this. Well, how do you know? And so, you know, there's a lot of, again, you're playing the what if game. There's a lot of what ifs, but you gamify exits, you gamify investing, you gamify all this stuff to figure out what would make sense, why it makes sense. Okay, we're going to get this money. Well, what are we going to do with it? How are we going to invest it? What are we going to use it for to grow our brand and invest in our company? You know, so it's a matter of walking through what success looks like and then reverse engineering the pieces to figure out, does that make sense? Can it work? And then how do you execute on that?
What surprised you most about working with your brother?
We're a good yin and yang. Typically, I'm the bad guy. Sometimes I'm the good guy. You know, he's in sales. And so he understands that side of it. He understands the marketing to a certain extent, and the sales process and how you sell to people. I'm a macro view type of guy. I like to look at the big picture and look at the pieces and figure out how it all works. And then obviously we got our partner, the distillery, and they're executing on making a good product, bottling it, packaging it, shipping it, as well as distributing it to where it needs to get to. And so along with selling in certain areas and et cetera. So we're all doing our parts. And as we continue to go, there's more and more facets to it. You know, we're like, okay, well, when do we start merchandise? When do we start a podcast? When do we start, you know, how do we start building the brand and kind of taking that next branch that we've kind of mapped out? When do we start all that? And when does it make sense to do some of this stuff? You know, he's been around long enough. He's a couple years older than me. He's an old bag of dirt. So we can, you know, kind of map out and divvy. You can't be in all these places at once. He's going to go here. I'm going to go here. We can do this together, you know, and just kind of map out what we can and can't do.
Do you feel like you have a huge competitive advantage by focusing kind of like grassroots social media, leveraging your personality, doing the podcast, being on Twitter, going on Instagram in order to sell this stuff? Because it's like super boots on the ground. Like that's how you sell booze.
It is. It 100% is. And yes, there are a bajillion celebrity whiskeys and this, or celebrity spirits, I should say. This is not a celebrity brand. This is the journey. Yes, my name is on that bottle now, but the goal and the long-term vision of this is the brand, the journey. It is about investing in people's stories and telling it along with a glass of whiskey and building out that brand, the journey, to bring people along for the ride and to get people invested and interested in all walks of life. and people's stories and why they're interesting. What is so interesting about Peter Lukow? Oh, well, let me tell you, he did this and he did that, and he was a part of this conversation. He was in this boardroom and he did that. I mean, the stories he can tell, people will be shocked. You know, oh my God, he was there for that? Oh my God, he was there for that? I mean, it's you know, I'm very interested in doing this podcast with him because I want to know these stories too. Because I know some of the rooms that he's been in. So, you know, I want to learn, and along that way, you hear about his journey and you're able to really kind of, you know, I'm a visual guy, listen and visualize things. I would watch players when I was growing up and I could see kind of things that they were doing, and I would try to implement it into my game if it made sense. And just by watching and seeing and having an understanding of why it worked and how it worked, I would implement it into my game. And I'm the same thing with business. Why do people look at things a certain way versus this other business person? And you know, reading a lot of books and having an understanding as to best practices and why you need to buck trends, why you need to go against the grain. So, you know, I think, as I said, the world doesn't need another whiskey. It needs a story. And ours is a great one.
What other brands are you inspired by as you think about Journey?
You know, you look at a lot of the different celebrity brands that are out there. You look at on the spirit side, but then you look at how companies have used grassroots to build their brand and build a following, and who are they speaking to? It's not a one size fits all. And you have to know your core consumer, who your target demographic is, who you're after. Our initial core market is hockey, because that's who knows me. And then from there, it's branching out from there and getting an understanding as to, okay, that's you're at your core market or who your consumer is going to be. Why are they going to choose to drink the Journey over something else? Okay. And then the flavor, how it sits. And then B, how you're marketing to them and how it speaks to them, how it makes them feel. Like anything, marketing, how does it make you feel? Are you proud to be a consumer of that product? I mean, ultimately that's what anyone does. And that's why you have all these crisis managers. Whenever something bad happens, they swoop in and they try to change the conversation quickly and try to manage expectations if there's an impending disaster. I mean, we could look at Boeing as a prime example. How do they change the conversation from a door falling off midair? I mean, holy shit.
Well, I think they changed it when a tire fell off another plane, but that wasn't a great story to pivot to.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it's, you know, I think you have to know who you're speaking to, why you're speaking to them, and why your product is a fit for them. And clearly, whiskey and hockey are synonymous with one another. So that's our core demographic. And then from there, we are going to branch out and expand and continue down our path.
Where do you think you get the most bang for the buck on the marketing side? Like, are you going to be blasting this logo on, I don't know, ice rink boards or something? Or are you more focused on grassroots, on the ground marketing? How do you figure that out?
That's actually a great question. We just talked about that this weekend in how moving forward into 2024, you know, we're obviously investing in social media, investing in branding and, you know, podcasts and, you know, all that social stuff. But where are we going to get the most bang for our buck? As you said, where can we get, you know, it, from a monetary perspective, does it make sense to spend the amount of money it takes to get into an arena and get into this or that? You know, we need to start looking at into that stuff, but right now it doesn't make sense. But it is, we've got a few ideas that we're brewing on that I think in the fall will be pretty interesting. And, you know, in the next couple months, we've got some some pretty good ideas that we're going to roll out with that I think make a lot of sense and will, I really think, help us grow our brand in the markets where we really want to focus.
I can't think of another whiskey brand that has the opportunity for the kind of nostalgia or just like the beautiful imagery that yours does. I mean, it's just like, you know, Canadian frozen lake, ice hockey rink, guys hanging around the fire or something. I mean, it's just like
in the ice shack, sipping on a whiskey, waiting to catch your dinner. No, we've thought of all of those and more. We're excited. We got a lot of cool things that we're going to be rolling out, but we need to build our brand and grow our following. Otherwise, we're just talking to ourselves. And so, you know, it's like the chicken and the egg, chasing your own tail. It's kind of, once you get to a little bit of scale, then you can do that to then hopefully get to mass scale. And so, you know, when that is and knowing when that is, you know, that's the trick. And that's an understanding as to figuring out where do you make those investments to get to that point and then go all in on branding, marketing, et cetera, and then kind of crank on it.
In real estate, negotiation is always a huge part of everything that I do. And I'm sure the things that you're doing in your life, but you're also in certain situations coming into new partnerships. And I wonder what you've experienced and your brother's experience has been changing teams and coming into a new room. How do you think about that on the business side in terms of like how to approach a new relationship, a new environment, a new deal? Like, what is your style?
That's, again, great question. Nobody's asked that one before.
Well, so I'm glad question. I'm not getting these stupid, I'm yeah, not asking no, stupid questions. That. I get stupid
my brother, answers. My brother's really good at this one. 16 teams, he's moved around a lot and needed to make new
I'll friends. I'll ask him on the podcast.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It is not easy, especially when you may be me and you're hated by everybody. And then you go into a new room. Not always the easiest transition, but it, like anything else, it's telling a story. It's making light of yourself, you know, making light of situations, not taking yourself too seriously, and knowing, you know, coming into a new room and talking business and et cetera, knowing what you're going in for, knowing the outcome you want, knowing what they're going to want, knowing why they want it, certainly helps you game plan as to what a win and a loss looks like. And ultimately, you want a win-win. In any business that I've been involved in, yes, sometimes somebody is not happy unless there's a winner and a loser. And more often than not, you never do business with that person again if you're on the losing side. If it's a win-win and you're coming, you know, whether it's a, you know, a hockey trade or a business transaction, what have you, when it's a win-win and somebody's getting something that they want and you get what you want, it's a win. And so finding out what that is and having a unique understanding as to the leverage points and how that plays out and why it may work that way helps you, again, reverse engineer and game plan for that situation.
I want to talk now about some of your other investments, and maybe we could start with real estate and how big of a strategy that's been for you.
Like everything I've told you, I've made a lot of mistakes.
I've made mistakes too.
So I've had a lot of wins and a lot of losses. You know, I think over the years, you know, it's funny. Like I tell players now, I'm a big proponent of not buying in the city you play in as a young player. Personally, that's my viewpoint. When I was coming into the league, it was always like you needed to show your loyalty to the team. You needed to show you're invested in the community and therefore you needed to buy a house or buy a place. Otherwise, you're going to be looked upon as a mercenary and whatever. So, you know, I bought in St. I was actually thinking about buying in Hartford before I got traded. Then I bought in St. Louis. Then I actually bought a house in Edmonton. I was there a year and then I sold it. Then I bought in California right in 2006. I don't know what you know what that was like, but I'm pretty sure 2006 was the top of the market. So you can only imagine. And then I got traded in 2009 out of California. Something in between 2006 and 2009 happened.
The great financial crisis.
That was not good. That was not good. I believe the three letters are GFC.
Yes.
So not good, and had a number of investment, you know, had housing, you know, housing investments and then other commercial real estate investments that did not end well, and learned a valuable lesson that I already knew, but that only reinforced it. And from that, like everything, every other loss, failure, defeat, whatever you want to call it, created a checklist or thesis on investing. And from that, understand who you're investing with, meaning, are they good people? If I had to do a handshake deal, would they be able to do it? Would they hold up their end of the bargain? We all need legal contracts. We all need the lawyers to do all this stuff. But at the end of the day, you're investing with the person. Are they upstanding and are they trustworthy? You know, does the deal make sense? What is the fee structure? Some of the deals that I was looking at were insane. Some guy was, you know, I had a group of people asking for money, you know, and again, it didn't necessarily, it wasn't targeted at me, but it somehow got on my desk. You know, these guys were buying 300 acres of land in Arizona and they were taking a massive fee and putting in zero. And I'm like, well, how's this make sense? Like, who's going to do, oh, sweat equity. I'm like, oh, great. Or I would get deals like, hey, here's this, you know, strip center. I would know the person and be like, oh, here's a strip center. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's okay. I know it. Yeah, interesting. Okay. We need 500 grand by Friday. It's Wednesday. Why are you asking me? Like, give me a break. And so, you know, as you go along, you just be like, no, you know, it's a hard no, no. If you have something tangible that doesn't have a 48-hour investment window, then bring it and I'll look at it. Like, the more deals I look at, the more deals you can look and see, you know, it's experience. That's a good deal. Why did I invest in that? Not that. Did it work out? Why did it work out? And then you keep adding to your investment thesis and your checklist as to why you do certain things so that now you can just go off that checklist and go, this fits all the criteria I'm looking for. And it can be a hotel. It can be an industrial property. It can be an office building. It can be whatever. But does it reach that criteria that you've now created based on success and failure? And, you know, maybe I started that too late, but we got it now and it works. So I invested in a Holiday Inn Express back in my hometown that did very well. I invested in a Hilton Garden Inn in Ames, Iowa, of all places, Iowa State. And that did well. You know, there was all kinds of, you know, I know you're a hotel guy. So I liked investing in hotels, something tangible, something you understood. Office buildings. Right now, the term office is persona non grata, but depending upon the market or the submarket and what they're doing to provide value or redesignated, whether it's class A, class B, whatever, how that works and what market is booming or busting, and where are they investing? You're not investing in a, I'm not investing in a fund that's just blanket buying a bunch of stuff. Where are they? What is their niche? Where, oh, we're investing in the South, in Texas, Florida, wherever. Okay. Or we're investing in Denver. Why Denver? Oh my God, it's booming. You know, why Minneapolis? Why Austin? Why Nashville? Why, you know, all these submarkets, and then the submarket inside the submarket and in specific locations. So more digging more into the detail as to where the deal is and why it may or may not work.
Real estate's a local game. I haven't really talked about this, but we've always been a hotel investor. I've always invested in hospitality, but recently got our first industrial deal under contract that we're closing on because it's a strategy that I want to grow out in a very, very, very specific market, like east of I-95 in Fort Lauderdale, Broward County, because it's my backyard. My wife owns basically the largest industrial property in the area, so we know this little pocket well. And there's something to be said about like a hyper focused strategy. Maybe that strategy evolves into be something wider, but at least initially, that's given me a lot of conviction that, yeah, sure, we don't have a lot of experience in industrial, but we've been investing in the hardest real estate asset class for the past, you know, 30 years. We can figure this
one out. Well, you have a unique understanding of that specific market too.
Yep.
And your journey takes you by there all the time.
100%. And that's the biggest reason why we have conviction, because what I've seen in the market throughout my journey and my time being here in South Florida. And now we've come full circle.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that's when people are, you know, I'll just put my athlete hat on. When you're an athlete and you're picking investments, sometimes you don't know what you don't know. And you don't have time to fly around all these places. And, you know, again, when I first started, there was no Zoom. There was no internet. There was none of this stuff. We wouldn't be doing this right now. You know, we'd be on the phone, and you probably didn't have a cell phone. I barely had a cell phone, and it was this big, and I probably didn't even need that. You have to have an understanding who to trust, why you're allocating money in certain directions, etc. But you don't need to know the finer details if you don't want, but you should know why are you investing 20% of your assets in real estate? Why are you investing in bonds? Why are you investing in the stock market or private equity or venture or whatever? Whatever asset class you want to look at, why are you doing that? And, you know, they can give you a book. And if they don't give you a book nowadays, again, we're in the internet age now. Watch a YouTube video. There's about 1,000 of them. If you don't want to read, watch it. It's right there in front of you. So I think a lot of, and you know, we're talking about athletes, but successful people that say they don't have time or say they don't have the resources just aren't paying attention. It's right in front of you. You can watch a YouTube video, take 10 or 15 minutes. One of the biggest issues I have with finances are school. They don't teach you nothing about finance. They don't teach. Why do they not teach you how to open a bank account? Just a simple checking account. What is a credit card? What is the debt on a credit card? Why do you not want that? Like, why are they not teaching this? But they're going to teach you about something stupid that doesn't have anything to do with your life. So that's another rabbit hole. Please don't go down.
I won't.
And my mom's a teacher.
Well, I've learned the most important things I've ever learned have been from peers and friends and mentors. It's not what I learned in school. That was just foundational stuff. It's like how to read.
Yeah. Yep. No, 100%. And I think that's the other you actually just hit the nail on the head. Finding good mentors and finding people that are willing to invest themselves in being your mentor. I've had a couple great ones in my life, and they've helped me immensely, both personally and professionally. You know, like, I'll give you a quick, I got hurt in Philly, knew my career was done. I called both of my mentors. They both flew to Philly within 2 days to meet with me. And it's funny, both of them told me the same thing. The main feedback, the same thing. Don't do anything for a year. Both had retired early, went back to work, you know, kind of, and both said, don't do anything for a year. Take meetings, take notes, talk to people, get an understanding of what's going on, but tell people you're taking a whole year to just get healthy, fix yourself, and then in a year's time or whenever that was, you're going to reevaluate and you're going to get back to them. And all the things that sounded amazing and, oh my God, this is going to be great, right when you probably would have accepted or said, oh my God, I want to do that. It's a great charity. By the time that year goes by and you've now listened to all these things, these business opportunities, and this guy wants to do this and this guy wants to do that, you're like, none of it speaks to you anymore. And you go back to, I really want to focus my 15% of my time on this charity. It speaks to me. I really love what they do. I want to be invested in this. And, oh, I still need to get healthy. And, oh, just saved an enormous amount of pain and time in just being diligent and letting people know you're interested, but you want to take some time to evaluate and see where your head's at once you fix yourself. And it's funny how I try to tell players going through similar situations to do that. And I always see a lot of players, they just want to get right back in. They feel like if they take that year to self-reflect, and a lot of times too, you don't, when you're in the middle of your career, you don't have time to think through what you've been able to accomplish. Enjoy the fruits of your labor, enjoy all the things that you were able to do and all the success. And before you're jumping right back into, I'm going to be a scout, I'm going to be a coach, I'm going to be a GM, I'm going to do this, I'm going to start this business. Oh my God, I got to get started. And they get burned out.
What was your biggest reflection during that year? The one that had the most impact on you?
I think just being diligent and taking your time. I had plotted out a career arc. When I first turned pro, you know, and I signed my first contract, I then, once I got established second year, I mapped out with my dad, all right, what do I think my career earnings are going to look like? What do I need to live on? How do I need to live, you know, and kind of, you know, like everything else, reverse engineer. And it was amazing just how the rocket ship of career, you know, contracts and salaries and everything was just escalating and going crazy during my time in the NHL. And what we mapped out was not even close to what I got to. But then that also, unfortunately, puts a target on your back as, you know, people, you don't know who to trust. You know, you're focusing on your craft and you're focusing on playing. And how do you still keep an eye on this over here, but you're focused on this and it needs your undivided attention, but you have all this money over here and you need to be a good steward and you need to invest wisely. And it's daunting, especially for people that don't have a semblance of finance or understand how complicated or uncomplicated we can make things when we talk about money and finance and business.
Chris, I asked all the guests on the podcast the same closing question, and your answer, I'm putting like a massive amount of high expectations on, because your wife is a luxury travel concierge? And if your answer is not, you know, up here in the top three of answers we've gotten, it's going to be upsetting. So what is your favorite hotel?
Ooh, there are a couple for different reasons. Rosewood Miramar Beach, just was at Montecito, Santa Barbara area. Incredible hotel, service. I mean, just great beach out front. I mean, it's a beautiful hotel. They did a great job on that. I would say Kalesma Mykonos, little boutique property in Mykonos. I think they got 27 rooms. Just the 27 identical rooms. Every room is the same. And it's not a room, it's a suite. Or like separate little one-bedroom villas. Incredible. Overlooking the bay and the water, Ornos Beach, Ornos Bay. Looking straight across at Santa Marina, Mykonos property. Fantastic place. Let's see here. What else? We go to Cabo a lot. I mean, you know, Montage Los Cabos is beautiful. Nice private, you know, just the beach area, everything, just the layout, the setup. It really depends, you know, the way we talk about it is, what are you going to do? Who's with you? You add in all these little details, and then that funnels into that a certain property as to, all right, you're with your kids, you're going here, and this is why, you know, here's the layout. So, you know, there's obviously a ton of properties. We love the Four Seasons there. It's up in the East Cape. So it's up north of the airport versus south where Los Cabos is. I mean, there's some incredible properties almost completed. You know, there's obviously a lot in New York. There are so many awesome properties. You know, Amangiri in Utah. I mean, I could keep going of ones that I'm like, wow, they hit it out of the park. That is a killer property that, depending upon what you're looking to do, it's an absolute home run. You know, St. Bart's Cheval Blanc is awesome. I mean, there's five hotels there that are, you know, five or 10, there's 10 hotels that are top notch, depending upon the part of the island you want to stay on. Really, you know, and do you want to get away from a bit of the action, or do you want to be right in the heart of the Eden Rock is right in the heart of Nikki Beach, right there, Nikki Beach, right beside it, Stumblebee Tuna back home. Your own little journey back to your hotel room.
That's right. I love it. We've got a trip planned. Thanks for coming on the podcast. This is amazing.
Thanks, Jake. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Hey, everyone. It's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.